This is CICK News. Thanks for joining us. I'm your host, Dan Messick. Each week, we provide an update about events and issues developing right across Northwest BC. CICK News is made possible by the Government of Canada and the Community Radio Fund of Canada, the only organization mandated to financially supporting campus and community radio stations across Canada. CICK Smithers Community Radio is on the dial at 93.9 FM, or you can listen online at smithersradio.com, and we are broadcasting from the unceded Gitindam Territory, home of the Wet'suwet'en Nation.
Today on CICK News, Brent Jolly is the president of the Canadian Association of Journalists, who operate out of Toronto. He's been involved in the organization for 3.5 years, and as a journalist, his beat is the ethics of journalism. Today on this episode of The Scrum, CICK News' monthly conversation with journalists, I'm speaking to Brent Jolly about the future of journalism in Canada. I spoke with Brent from his office in Toronto. I learned about the Canadian Association of Journalists through an odd web search that led me to learning about the Code of Silence. Firstly, the name alone piqued my interest. But in reading about it, the Code of Silence Award is, in my opinion, a much-needed dose of sarcasm in the world of newscasting and reporting. The Code of Silence Award is given annually by the Canadian Association of Journalists, the Centre for Free Expression at Ryerson University, News Media Canada, and Canadian Journalists for Free Expression, to call public attention to governments, government departments, and agencies that put extra effort into denying public access to government information to which the public has a right under access to information legislation. Past recipients are the Environment and Climate Change Canada, a federal department responsible for informing Canadians about protecting and conserving our natural heritage and ensuring a clean, safe, and sustainable environment for present and future generations, and the Municipality of Niagara Falls, as well as the RCMP. Yes, the award is facetious, and yes, it's rife with snark. But in the pursuit of truth and public transparency, the Code of Silence Award is the dose of sarcasm many Canadian journalists can agree is welcome. Let's listen now to my conversation with Brent Jolly, president of the Canadian Association of Journalists, about the history of this award and what he plans to do as president of this organization.
My name is Brent Jolly, and I'm the president of the Canadian Association of Journalists.
Thank you so much for speaking with me today, Brent. Can you tell me, what is the Code of Silence Award?
Yeah, the Code of Silences Award is perhaps my favorite awards competition in Canada. Not to, you know, to look over, you know, awards that give out journalist excellence, but I think that this is a really cool one because it's an award, but it's not an award that you would go out and strive to win. You know, it's sort of a tongue-in-cheek effort, hence the Code of Silence. That, you know, looks at federal government departments, provincial government departments, municipalities, and law enforcement, and hands out an award each year based on submissions that are made to us about efforts that, you know, they have done to try and infringe upon the public's right to know.
And how did this award start, and who started it?
Yeah, so the Code of Silence Award started more than 20 years ago. It was an effort that the Canadian Association of Journalists started. It was something that we would typically give out every year at our national conference that we would have. So, you know, we have a professional development conference in a city every year for journalists. You know, from Vancouver to St. John's, we'll go anywhere across the country to in any given year. And what we focused on is looking at infringements of the public's right to know is something that's really critical of the CAJ's public interest advocacy work. And so it sort of came out of that nexus and thinking about, you know, some of the challenges that journalists have had and the challenges they face as well in terms of the obfuscation from various government departments, you know, whether it's the federal government's law enforcement, municipalities, provincial governments, in providing information that is in the public interest. And also it sort of dovetails a lot with the CAJ's access to information efforts to modify and update that.
You know, while the award has a facetious tone to it, what are, in your opinion, the most serious implications of governments keeping information from the public?
Yeah, I think it's, you know, it's that's very true. The name of the award and the focus of the award is slightly, yeah, facetious is a great word to describe it. But it really hits home on the importance of, you know, being able for the public to being able to understand the information and the actions of their government officials. You know, at the end of the day, being able to access information is critical to democracy and transparency. And what we've seen recently in the last several years is more and more government agencies, you know, tightening the screws on efforts to be transparent, to try and keep more documents suppressed and information suppressed. And, you know, it's sort of like a chapter out of, you know, The Handmaid's Tale or 1984, to be honest with you, in some cases, with the tight-fisted nature of how people try and government agencies and civil servants try and, you know, circumvent access to information and privacy legislation to ensure that that information comes out.
Has this award or the notoriety for the department after receiving the award, has it ever made real change happen within a government department that's received it?
I think that there's yes and no. I mean, I think that there is an element of naming and shaming, and I think this is part of bringing it to the forefront. I like to think that, you know, a couple of years ago we had the Jason Kenney's Alberta, the war room that they had where they, you know, developed sort of like a communication shop to attack enemies of the energy sector. I would note that a couple of years later, you know, the budget of that war room was cut by about 90% and was ultimately, you know, disassembled because of the pandemic. Perhaps that's just, you know, two variables working at the same time, but we definitely were quite hard on that issue, and we did see it disappear during the pandemic. So I'm not sure if we can connect the two dots, but definitely that's one that stands out for me. I think that there's definitely, you know, it's important for the public to understand that, you know, that basic transparency matters, and that dodging requests for interviews or refusing to let, you know, journalists or the public know when a city council is meeting, you know, is fundamental to the proper operation of a democratic society.
So have you seen any of the nominees this year? The applications just closed last Friday, which was October 15th. So I'm not sure if you've seen or you can comment on nominees for this year, but if not, who are some of the most notable, in your opinion, from years past?
Yeah, no, unfortunately, I haven't had a chance to see it at all the applications yet. I've been organizing this online hate conference, and for all the journalists that have been receiving online hate or harassment or hateful messages. So I'm kind of knee deep in that unfortunate little ecosystem right now. Ironic, perhaps, but nevertheless, really, really important. And but some of the places that we've seen before, I mean, you know, looking at federal departments, right, from the federal cabinet was named last year for, you know, not disclosing information about monies that were given out of the public purse in the Canada accounts. You know, the Department of Environment and Climate Change was nominated. The RCMP, you know, coming back to what you were saying about the Ferry Creek case, you know, about how they've attempted to sort of circumvent a lot of efforts of transparency and, you know, exempting various documents from freedom of information or, you know, just making ridiculous accusations. Like, I know there was one case last year with the Ottawa Police Service. Somebody applied to receive some documents to explain why a family member had died in an accident. And the Ottawa Police Service charged them an exorbitant fee in the thousands of dollars to be able to access this report, which is completely antithetical to any idea or any notion of transparency.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Can you tell me how the National Board of the Canadian Association of Journalists is selected? Because you have quite an extensive board there.
It's quite a large board, and I'm really we've got a great board. Not to sound too Trumpian here, but we've got a wonderful board of directors from, you know, provinces across the country. You know, we've got, you know, three directors in Nova Scotia. We've got a director in the north. We've got, you know, all the provinces, you know, save for New Brunswick and Newfoundland, are represented. And that's something I think is really powerful, that we're able to do that. We are a bilingual association, and so directors are elected from, they decide to put their name forward because they're concerned about something in journalism. They have a pet project or something that they want to see changed. And so they decide to run. And we have, we do professional development for members. We do events, we do the advocacy stuff, and lately we've been doing some more research. We're coming out with our diversity survey, the first time that we've done this, of Canadian media. So it's going to be a look into seeing, the gender and ethnic composition of newsrooms and sort of where things are, because, we've heard a lot about that over the last, couple of years, that's been a major issue. And also, doing some training for the public as well about misinformation and, disinformation and sort of good digital hygiene tactics and techniques, so that you're able to discern, truth from lies, because that's really critical right now, especially for the news business. It's easy to churn out 12 pieces of fabricated, falsehoods, as opposed to one piece of accurate, reliable, quality journalism. So I think that's important to explain to the public how things get done and how things get made.
Brent, was there anything else that you think that our listeners should know that I didn't ask?
The only thing I'd find interesting perhaps is to think about how local journalists are treated by city councils, town councils, and municipal bodies. And how that's changing based on the media environment, because we don't have, at least in my example, in Southern Ontario, but this holds true in other provinces too. There are individuals who have worked at, the city's major publication, newspaper, radio station, but who have gone off to do an individual project, or start up their own business because they see an opportunity there, because maybe the newspaper in their city closed. And some of the challenges that the city officials present to these individuals who, are members of, national self-regulatory organizations, they're members of the CHA, they hold themselves to, ethical principles and codes of conduct. But, municipal officials, really try and run interference with these individuals and prevent them from being able to access, city council events or documents or things like this. And that's something that really concerns me, because I think we're going to see more disruption in the news business as things go forward. And I think that there's really an importance of having some literacy for these municipal officials to understand, that journalism is a self-regulated profession. There's not, a license that people carry. And I think this holds true exactly with the same with Berry Creek, what we saw with some of the RCMP officers there, that this is that freedom of the press is enshrined in the Constitution, and that holds true at the national level, and it holds true at Main Street in any community across the country. And so I think that we need to be able to be ready and be prepared to push back and to ensure that our rights to freedom of the press are upheld under all circumstances.
Is that something that the CHA website offers as well in way of resources for journalists?
It's funny, because this is something that we've noticed that there's definitely a need for coming out of the Fairy Creek events over the course of the summer, in terms of identifying and understanding reporters' rights and responsibilities, both for journalists and for, authorities. When I say that, I mean governments, municipalities, law enforcement. So I think that that's something that we're definitely going to be looking at developing, because I think that there is that sort of misunderstanding around, what the role of journalism is. For example, we've seen a lot of law enforcement bodies think that, journalists and protesters are sort of the same thing.
Right.
And there's plenty of case law to, shut that down. But nevertheless, it's it's one of those things that in the heat of the moment, the law enforcement bodies are the ones with the power to say, no, you can't go here, or you can't, you know, take that picture or interview this person. And then you have to go through the court system to find a remedy to it, which, you know, just isn't timely. So having those resources that people can pull out and say, no, this is why, and this is how it works, I think would be very, very helpful to a lot of people.
What's your experience with the Canadian Association of Journalists and as a journalist yourself?
I've been a journalist for, gosh, about 10 years now in the business. I've worked at, in newsrooms, both as a writer and editor, as a freelancer. The last 5 years, I've been balancing that with being with the National News Media Council, which is the self-regulatory organization for newspapers, digital news organizations, magazines, to hear complaints from the public about news coverage, and uphold, you know, best practices on ethics and all that kind of stuff. I got involved in the CAJ because I saw that there was a need, and I had, A, I had time, and B, I was interested in seeing, you know, how the journalism world could better work together to solve problems as opposed to work individually in separate spheres. And, you know, we'll let history be the judge of how successful that is. But I do see a lot of opportunities arising over the last several months, even where there is some of that breaking down of organizational ethos and individual, you know, organizational, interests. And the two cases that come to mind are the Ferry Creek case, what happened there, and seeing how news organizations, you know, work together to be able to champion both their own interests in order to access materials and have access to the site to be able to report in the public interest, but also how they were willing to work together to ensure that they were able to share information and put together a compelling court case. That was one. The second, I think, has been in the wake of this whole, you know, Maxime Bernier calling out journalists on Twitter and, you know, the whole, saying that his followers should play dirty with them and doxing them in that way. I think that has really shown there's an interesting window going on right now where the interests of journalists and the interests of news organizations are both working in very good synchronicity. And to me, that's when policy change happens and when things get better and people get serious about doing things. And so I'm really encouraged by that, you know, that out of some of these incredible trials and tribulations, both individually and collectively, we're able to show resilience as a sector, and to be creative and nimble to come up with solutions that will help us in the long term and continue on for the next, you know, the next crop of journalists and, you know, news organizations that potentially don't even exist yet.
Yeah. It's actually funny just hearing, I guess, your approach to not only journalism, but the machine that journalism has to work within, and how now there seems to be a few more little barriers to step over. Not to say that journalists before didn't have, you know, their own challenges, obviously, but I think especially with a lot of misinformation going out online and that misinformation being very compelling. And then that's how, you know, conspiracy theories become apparently news. I work in an organization, so I'm actually hired through the CRFC, Community Radio Fund of Canada, and we're part of a project called the LJI, Do you know about the LJI project?
The local journalism.
That's right. Yeah. And I find that it's such an interesting, just hearing you speak about, I guess the approach to journalism is so interesting, because in these electronic newsrooms that we have every week, a lot of us are first time journalists. We didn't go to school for it. Like, I myself went to school for photography, fell into journalism through writing and radio and just interviewing people, and then, found my way into more of a news and journalistic approach to interviewing people, which I don't think is actually too different from just interviewing someone. But it's just so interesting, because I think that there definitely is that distinction is becoming a little foggier now. And I think that people are kind of nominating themselves to be journalists in a way that it's dangerous, because you can, but there are still so many webs to understand and to actually know how to approach your rights as a journalist, but also how and when you can tell someone else's story. It seems like that's sort of been a bit of a value of yours, it seems like, personally, as a journalist in that story. In your history, is there a reason for that?
I never really thought about that, but I think, I think the advantage that I have is I have the liberty of being able to sit back and sort of see the big picture. In the day to day, I'm not a day to day, reporter on deadline every single day, where I have to chase people on specific things and then start all over again. And I think that's a unique opportunity that's been afforded to me, is being able to, see the whole thing and to talk to, different people, from in BC and Quebec and Ontario and everywhere in the north. That's the advantage, I think, that we have as well from our board. We're not just a regional association, we're a national association in the true sense of it. And we're able to bring all those different perspectives together and sort of see what's going on and what is the best course of action, not just necessarily for, Ontario-based community newspapers, but for the whole industry as a whole. I think that's a very valuable, perspective to have. And it's a lot of work. It's a lot of work to be able to make sure that that's balanced, and that, various different interests are being accounted for and respected. But, I think at the end of the day, being able to help the public understand what journalism does and why it's important is, our number one goal, and to represent the interests of journalists based off of that, and I think that's sorely needed in a place where, you have a lot of politicians or, personalities online, denigrating the industry and the profession as, being worthless. I couldn't disagree more in a time like this.
Absolutely. My last question for you, Brent, is how does someone become a member of the Canadian Association of Journalists?
Yeah. Any journalist can become a member. There are various, different scales or types of memberships that we have. There's the person who's the full-time, works at a national daily or, a national television station or radio station. Then there's, others. There's student class memberships, freelance, people who are freelancing, early career, late career. There are various different ones. So if people are interested, I would suggest they go to our website, which is caja.ca, and try and pick the one that would be best for them. And it will go through, we have a membership committee where we go through and do all the vetting to make sure that we're, letting in people who are who they say they are and the qualifications that they have. And we go from there.
Okay, great. Brent, thank you so much for giving me this much time today. I really appreciate it. And I'm so excited to share the code of silence with our listeners. And I hope that they get as excited about it as I did.
Awesome. I'm glad to hear you're excited about it, because I'm excited about it. And I'm a nerd, so it's nice to hear some external validation.
Okay, so thanks a lot. Have a great day, Brent.
Thanks, Pam.
Thanks again for tuning in to CICK News. If you have any hot tips or news stories you think we should cover, contact us at CICKnews@smithersradio.com or follow us on Facebook at CICK News. You can also catch our fresh shows each week at skeenastrong.com or subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you find your podcasts. Thanks again to our producer, Pam Hassan, and all of our roving reporters. I'm Dan Messick. Thanks for listening.